Hi, and welcome to Prosody, a weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers on 90.5 FM. This summer, we're featuring the best of prosody. We hope you enjoy. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet Celeste Gainey. Celeste Gainey is a native Californian now living on the East End of Long Island. For most of her life, she has worked in the fields of film production and architectural lighting design. She was the first woman ever to be admitted to the International Alliance of Theatrical Stage Employees as a gaffer and worked on such films as Taxi Driver and Dog Day Afternoon. She recently completed her MFA in Creative Writing Poetry at Carleau University. Her work has been published in the anthologies Long Island Sounds and the forthcoming Writing Outside the Lines. Her poetry has been nominated for a Pushcart Prize, and her book, In the Land of Speculation and Seismography, has been chosen as the runner-up for the 2010 Robin Becker Chapbook Prize, awarded by Seven Kitchens Press, for a chapbook of poetry by a lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgendered, or queer writer. Hi, Celeste. How you doing?
Hey, Jan. I'm fine. It's great to be here. Thank you for asking me.
It's great to have you, and I can't wait to hear some of these poems, so please go ahead.
Okay. A lot of my poetry has to do with my experience of California growing up there. And so I'm going to start with a poem that has to do with my childhood in that great land. It's called I Grew Up on Top of a Hill. I grew up on top of a hill. If I rode my bike down, I had to push it all the way back up. My native land stretching out below like an aerial of Oz. Endless ocean, a window for sunsets, each more red than the last. Islands lurking, large birds circling, no children, trick-or-treaters, no sidewalks, only bridle paths, ruddy pines and oaks ate up the slopes. Mrs. Rupp on her Appaloosa, weathered cancer face under her Stetson, Jaguar roadster flashing by. I rode shotgun, had a sombrero as big as the car. Me and the imaginary offspring of movie stars at imaginary desks in the garden room. I hated naps, liked talking to strangers. I'd read to anyone who'd listen. I was fat, snuck Three Musketeers bars, wore cowboy boots from Jedlicka's. My shirt had enameled snaps, my jeans metal buttons. I carried a gun, cold to the touch, made my hands smell like pennies. When I started school, I took a lunchbox, pale blue background, red tractors, silos, cows inside a thin white grid. I was made to wear a uniform and carry pressed handkerchiefs embroidered with the days of the week in French. Gloves too, a beret, name sewn on the inside. The second poem also has to do with California and is really inspired by the generation of Midwesterners, my parents included, who flocked to California in the post-World War II boom and really created the California that we know today. And this is also the title poem of my chapbook, In the Land of Speculation and Seismography. In the land of speculation and seismography, there are dwellings made of future, low-slung eaves and camphor wood structures, unspooling the coast like chambered fog, clinging to jutting scarps, glass-front cantilevers containing lost Midwest revelers, unsuspecting under ceilings of roiling ocean waves. The first to make the scene, strike a pose for modernity, sitting on air like stiffs, smiling at what? The sea. They would learn quickly to eat the whole enchilada with hot sauce, sip margaritas in the afternoon, listen nervously for the daylight down the tracks at the end of the day. Highballs and hi-fi, haiku of the no ties, yes, my lifestyle. If this was the price to be paid for never waking to snow or leafless trees, walking upstairs, growing gray hair, all eyes ahead, boulevards of palm, dreams of dichondra, horizons of flagstone. Never mind the hobos by the bird refuge, rattlers in the foothills, children in the driveway, tremors on the fault line. So now we move to another preoccupation of my writing, which is my time working in the field of lighting And first I started out in motion pictures, and then I segued into architectural lighting design. And one question I always got when I was working in movies, and I still do, is when I tell people that I was a gaffer, the question, what is a gaffer? And so that's really the question that this poem answers. And it's called The Gaffer. Lamplighter, chief lighting technician on a film set, the DP's go-to guy, dispenser of gaffer's tape, of brute arc myths, day for night and the anti-auteur theory, transposer of sun, shadow, nuancer of mood, romancer of stars. She wears a train engineer's jumpsuit, rod labor tennies, cutoffs, and a t-shirt that says strip and screw, drives a panel van with blacked out windows, a hunky T-bird back to Levittown, the first electric car. Calls you on Christmas weeping, wants to get into your pants, be forgiven right away. Doesn't want the job to end, to go home, be a regular Joe. Let no one see you're under pressure. Make them believe you can light the scene in the John, single bare bulb hanging down. Let the eyes go black. I should say there that I refer to the DP, which means the director of photography, on a film set.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet Celeste Gainey. You know, I really like the California poems and the sense of longing and memory that is evoked by all these details, this cataloging of details. And I know, well, I think I know that you love California, but can you talk about that, the challenge of evoking longing and memory without tripping into the sentimental?
Wow, that's interesting. That's a good question. Immediately, I think, first of all, of, Frank O'Hare is one of my favorite poets, just about my favorite poet. And there's a line that he says, attention equals life. So I think the detail is one way that you stay out of the sentimentality. And also with California, what's interesting is that people always ask me now that I live on the East Coast, they go, oh, don't you miss California? And I tell them, well, I missed it when I lived there. And so there's this, there's this mystique about California. It's a state of mind. And it's mythological to a great degree. So I think when you're from someplace like that, there's a lot to play with. And I think it helps to avoid sort of the direct emotional content of personal experience. So I think it's that detail and also the craft of working with the language to try to keep working out. I can fall for sentimentality just like the next person. I mean, I'm probably a bigger sentimentalist than many. But I think it's just the revision, the working with craft, the keep going, you know, to keep going for very particular detail that keeps you out of I guess what you would say would be cliche or the simple emotional response.
Mm-hmm. Well, would you say in the California poems that you're aiming towards the mythology and the state of mind of California, or are you more looking to complicate that vision, including the real California, if there is a real California?
Well, there are a lot of variables here. I think, I could answer this a million ways. Okay, I think that there's my experience of California, which I'm trying to convey. I want to make it more complex. I want to go someplace that I don't even know I'm going. And I don't think I'm even there yet. That's where I'm trying to go with my work. So, you know.
Yeah. It seems like there will be many California poems.
I think there will be.
Yeah.
And someone like Eleni Sicilianos, with her, her project, she wrote an entire poem that's a book called The California Poem. And that poem is a great inspiration to me. It's her particular project. No one else could have written it. And not that I see myself necessarily writing an entire book of one poem on California. But in my own way, I want to keep exploring and discovering my you know, my little tunnel into the California experience. So that's sort of my purpose in writing the California poems.
Okay. Can you read some more poems?
Okay, great. We're going to move now to New York. And this is another poem about my film experience. And it's about my experience of working on the film Taxi Driver. And it's called Between Takes. And the poem has an epigraph. On the set of Taxi Driver, Columbus Circle, summer 1975. And before I begin, I should say that the thing to remember is that in the summer of 1975, there were no women who worked what we call below the line in a technical capacity on film. And so this was really the second time that a woman had ever worked in that capacity. The first time was Dog Day Afternoon, and I was that woman at that time. So this was really unusual, and you have to remember the Columbus Circle is like the vortex of New York City, and there were a lot of people that were walking by. So here we go with the poem. Between Takes. De Niro idles in his checker. Sybil flirts behind her Jackie O's. Scorsese sucks oxygen from a tiny tank trailed by an assistant. Albert Brooks hogs the PA. When using the moving sidewalk, please stand to the right. If you wish to pass, please do so on the left. Over and over. Grips lay dolly track for a shot we all know will never make the final cut, but will take most of the day to shoot. Me in my 501s and Mighty Mouse t-shirt, 20 feet up, work gloves and pliers protruding. The brute arc light I tend sputters and hisses beside me. Like that famous New Yorker cover showing the world as seen from Ninth Avenue, the land of make-believe below foreshortens my vision, rises up to swallow me whole. I try to lean as if belonging against the unsteady rungs of my ladder, oblivious to the real world down there too, passing me by. Most jaded New Yorkers, their eyes on the prize, but maybe some looking up and wondering, what's that girl doing up there in the sky, flying so close to the sun? Some kind of myth with pliers. This next poem is also inspired by my younger days in New York and the 70s. And I guess another little project of mine is the idea of clothing and identity and really the trying on of clothes and the trying on of gender and the exploration of all of that. Not so much fashion, but just clothing as an expression of that identity. So this poem is called In the Days of Early Polyester. In the days of early polyester, you don't know yet you are flammable. Jars of Miracle Whip, tubs of polyo in the fridge. Your moral imperative on ice, the vertical blinds rattling shut. Sleek sofa of solid kerosene, resisting your body's impression. You keep saying, cotton, cotton, the touch, the feel of cotton. But you are drawn to the slinky boy shirt with the Kandinsky-like print. Fancy your stubbled sideburns whiskering the top of its Byron-esque collar, long points gesturing toward no breast torso, slim hips, bell-bottom legs, fry boots. It feels like Velveeta against your skin, something you might scrape off with the blade of your Swiss Army knife. It seems to reject you. Still, you can't stop parading your shirt through Washington Square Park in the hot afternoon sun, looking for combustion. This next one is a new poem. And again, it has to do with clothing. And this is really a shout out to my more fashion-challenged lesbian sisters. And it's called To Dykes Who Don't Know How to Wear Ties. If you're going to wear one, wear it for real. Wear it with your all-white First Holy Communion suit or gray flannel and shiny black wingtips, a cheap short-sleeved shirt from Penny's with pocket protector, trench coat and fedora, skinny jeans, white socks and penny loafers, a modish jacket, long-sleeved work shirt with the name Bud above the flap. Wear it like you must, like it's not a choice, it's not cool, a mano-a-mano tradition. Learn your foreign hand, your half Windsor, your full Windsor, your Shelby, and most definitely, your bow tie. Be able to knot any of them in an emergency without a mirror. Shop for your ties carefully, never buy a cheap tie. Note the silk content, the finishing stitch on the backside. Dry clean only and often. Invest in a tie rack. Arrange your ties in color blocks, favorites first. Get up in the morning knowing which tie you'll wear. Let your tie define your day. Dad had one, cornflower blue with a lone golden unicorn at the center. Whenever he wore it, my parents fought. I have one, Italian silk knit. Whenever I wear it, I'm crossing on the SS France, leaning over an ebony glass top table in Bar de l'Atlantique, seducing a handsome stranger back to my stateroom. This reminds me, don't get too carried away with the romance of the tie, unless you're ready for it. Ready to cultivate your place in the demimonde of the other sex that eddies inside you. Best stick to being a regular Joe, knowing without thinking it's your inheritance. The tie is always there inside your closet, around your neck. Just keep it real. So now we move on to some love poems. Oblique love poems, but love poems nevertheless. And this first one is called My Dearest Lover. My dearest lover, greetings from Bikini Atoll. Boy, is it hot here, and oddly, not a speck of sun. Wish I were with you in the snowy northeast. You'd never believe the sights, these clouds. Wow, big as giant mushrooms. The sand, scorched and smoky, glowing orange. Too hot to walk on, unless you are an aspiring yogi, which, as you know, I am not. The skin-flayed natives are kind and quiet. Too quiet, even for me. They do not speak, but draw strange pictographs in the angry sand with long sticks that are always catching fire and combusting to ash before they can finish whatever it is they have to say. The silence is like none I've ever heard, just the faintest crackle crackle of burning sand and flesh, and always a low whoosh, whoosh. The kind of sound I recall the X-ray machine making at the Mayo Clinic as its long shadow passed over, exposing the dead in me. Ridiculous, isn't it, how full of sound silence can be, even out here lost in the Pacific, a speck at the flaming end of things. I wish I could hear your voice. So this next one, also a love poem, is a period piece. I have kind of a joke with my partner. We say that we were lovers in another era, probably two gay men together. And so this is a poem inspired by that idea. And in this poem, I mention the name Billy Haynes, who was a very, very famous silent screen star and who actually gave up his career rather than deny his homosexuality. And he went on to become a very very well-known interior designer, designing, you know, homes for Joan Crawford, Lucille Ball, et cetera, et cetera. So that's a name that I mention in this poem. And this is called When Men Wore Handkerchiefs. Back when men wore handkerchiefs in their breast pockets, I would press a crisp, bright square over my hidden heart for you. It would look snappy against the imported alpaca of my sport jacket, the collar of my very white polo shirt spread open a la Billy Haynes, the tan of my smooth skin peeking through. An actor of the silent era, I would learn to be manly and discreet, never disclosing our desire for each other's sameness, how you give it to me exactly the way I want it. But then there would be that afternoon at the lawn party in front of LB's guests, when the shuttlecock glances your eye, and I leap to you like a lioness to her cub, pluck my handkerchief, snowy mute thunderclap of initialed surrender to dress your wound, and like that, just like that, the world stops.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet Celeste Gainey. You know, I really loved when you said this is a love poem, an oblique love poem. You know, as if a direct love poem would just not do the job, you know, or be less compelling. Or,
well, I wish I could write a direct love poem, but
really, do you?
I guess. I mean, if it could be done really well, you know, just like I keep writing in search of California, I keep writing in search of the great love poem.
Okay.
I mean, how can you express it? I guess, you know, you have to just get oblique about it.
Well, let me ask you this. Maybe it's something else. I mean, it struck me that this idea of mythology might be at work on a lot of levels. Like, I'm wondering if some of what you're doing is breaking down the mythology around identity and place. For example, you know, breaking down the romanticization and objectification of place and gender. And if you're doing that, it seems like it would have to be an oblique love poem rather than direct, you know, because there's so many bad love poems, so many oversimplified and romantic love poems, or poems of, you know, poems that, you know, there aren't enough, obviously, poems about gender that complicate the idea of gender. So I don't know if this sort of, like, not an attack on mythology, but a engagement with mythology and, you know, sort of taking it apart is part of what you're doing on a lot of levels. I don't know if that's...
Yeah, I think that maybe I'm not hearing you correctly, but I think you're sort of talking about correct me if I'm wrong, you're sort of talking about an accepted mythology that we're born into or that we all seem to accept without question. But I'm more interested in the personal mythology and, you know, owning it. So I think that we... Especially as a gay person, you have to make very conscious decisions early on about your life. So I'm not saying that I'm more aware or was more aware at the time than any ordinary human being or any heterosexual person. I just know for myself that there were certain decisions that I had to make that made me a little bit more aware of my own actions. And so I think that that's kind of has helped me to be able to write some of the poems that I'm writing now, because I have a memory that's very specific and is very real for my own personal experience.
Okay.
You know, and I'm not sure that that's true for everybody. But for me it is. And I think I am exploding the myth, but I'm exploding it, but at the same time I'm exploring that myth as I identify it for myself,
mm-hmm.
you know, and kind of claiming it.
Right. I mean, the speaker in the poems, you know, wearing with the tie poem is great. I mean, I really like that. But a lot of the clothing poems, you talk about owning personal mythology or exploring personal mythology through the clothing poems.
I mean, clothes are a language. So I'm kind of, you know, that's sort of what I'm doing. I'm sort of, it could be. You know, I could be writing in another I'm writing sort of in another language, mm-hmm. in a sense, because, you know, we use clothes, I think especially when you're younger, you use clothes as a means of communicating who you are or trying different things on. So that's sort of what I'm trying to do in those poems. You know, it's like finding the right word,
mm-hmm.
like finding the right piece of clothing. So there's sort of this double work that's going on in those poems of trying to find the right word to communicate and trying to find the right article of clothing, you know, the alpaca sport jacket, you know.
Okay.
So the bow tie,
yeah.
the white, all-white First Holy Communion suit. I mean, these things that just sort of, you know, are there.
And how to wear it, too.
Yeah, and how to wear it. Yeah, mm-hmm. definitely how to wear it.
Okay. Can you read a couple more poems, please?
Okay. This poem is a poem that I consider, you know, very personal. It's sort of like a manifesto, perhaps. And it's a poem that is born of the first object of desire. And the first thing I can remember ever wanting or asking for as a child was a bird. And this was for my third birthday. So this poem comes out of that wanting or desire. And it's called I Always Wanted a Bird. I always wanted a bird, a sombrero, cowboy boots and button-up jeans like a boy, a coloring book history of the United States, a burro, not a donkey, and a mother-of-pearl accordion, the ceremonial Indian headdress, the bamboo spear with the big rubber tip, the ochre dress with stripes going the wrong way, my father to stop drinking, my sister to protect me, my brother to disappear, a hickory deluxe burger and chocolate chip shake at Peterson's Drive-In, spare ribs and potato salad from Pupo's Delicatessen on my birthday, popcorn and Pepsi on Sunday nights. I always wanted a canary, the best grades in the class, white buck saddle shoes, Kennedy for president, to be a tennis champion, save my mother from my brother, be the governor of California, head of Time Inc., to not be fat, to be better at math, escape to boarding school, ride my bike casually, tan easily, and live on the beach at Malibu, in a penthouse at the Beverly Hilton, in the Monsanto House of Tomorrow at Disneyland, at the plaza like Eloise, to drink tiki punch at Trader Vic's, ride the subway in New York, eat sweet butter on date nut bread at Bullock's Wilshire, Cobb salad at the Brown Derby. I always wanted a canary in a round silver cage, to fly first class, wear a tie and waistcoat, make money but not care, be famous but not too, be the woman and man of my dreams, be born at the end of the 19th century, live in the demi-monde of Paris, the New York School in the 50s, La Nouvelle Vague in the 60s. To love someone as much as my mother, be like the lilies of the field, a pilgrim at the Ganges. To walk the sleepless streets of Greenwich Village, the wide beaches of the Hamptons, the groomed pathways of the Champ de Mars, the icy avenues of Reykjavik. Live in isolation, die sooner rather than later, erase myself. I always wanted a canary in a round silver cage, singing.
It's the poetry of Celeste Gainey. Thank you so much, Celeste. That was wonderful.
Okay, it's been really great, Jan. Thank you.
Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment Newsweekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Alan Wadey. Our sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in at our new time, Saturday mornings at 6:30 for Prosody, your weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers on 90.5 FM.